Okay, so we're getting on our last session very badly, and we're going to look at modesty. We're going to do a little comparison. I'm going to spend more time on Islam, but we'll start off with a little look at concepts of modesty, particularly for women in Judaism, because it's a big thing in the Western world. There are a lot of controversies about hijab and about how Muslim women dress, and people have opinions. So it might be interesting to look at that. I thought that would be a good topic to end with because it's very contemporary. So both religions have a concept of modesty that applies to both men and women. It covers things like behavior and speech and interaction between the sexes and dress. And I have to say that both religions have always focused on women. How they dress is the main expression of modesty, even though that might not actually be really the true meaning of modesty in either religion. But there you are, that's what's happened in both religions. And in the case of Islam, it's been complicated in the West, because of Western notions of appropriate dress and behavior for women, compared to which Islamic notions, or some Islamic notions about women's dress and behavior, seem very, very different. And the problem is less acute for Jews, because we can pass. Women's modesty practices in Judaism are much more invisible. We are quite good at camouflaging it. Many people don't realize that women are wearing shaitels, or they've got a hat on for a reason. So we stand out much, much less. We're much more invisible in general society, and that's why the Jewish community doesn't usually get a lot of pushback on modesty practices. You will notice that there's pushback on Hasidic clothing practices because people look different and nobody likes people who look different. And for the Muslims also, the discourse about how women dress is very much mixed up with things like Islamophobia and concern about the introduction of Muslim communities in the West. So we'll unpack some of this. We'll start with a brief survey of the halakha on the Jewish side, because it's quite interesting to compare. Some of the same issues come up. Then we'll move on to Islam. And as I said, we're going to look at women's dress as the main feature of modesty that keeps coming up. So the Torah nowhere commands women to wear anything in particular. The only dress-related commandments are the prohibition on cross-dressing, that men shouldn't wear women's garments, women shouldn't wear men's garments. There's a whole field of debate there. So, for instance, in the Middle East, trousers are a women's garment. So, where are we talking? There's also the non-gendered prohibition of wearing sha'atnez, fabric that's made from linen and wool, which is a sort of, which is God's private holy fabric, and we don't wear it. There's also the commandment to attach tzitzit or fringes to the corner of your garments. That doesn't have a gender marker in the Torah. Rabbinically, it does, but definitely not in the Torah. And there is a rabbinic dispute as to whether that applies to men or women. So where do our current regulations, certainly in the Orthodox world, for women's dress and hair covering come from? The source for hair covering is actually rabbinic. And it comes from a rabbinic interpretation of a Torah verse. In the rabbinic idea, it's a Torah verse, but it clearly is a rabbinic interpretation. So we're going to look at that source from Bamidbar. And this is a verse that comes out of the account of the Sota ritual, which is the ritual that's carried out when a woman is suspected by her husband of committing adultery. And we won't go into the details, but as part of the description is a part of the whole thing from Bamidbar, then the priest shall bring her near, this is the suspected woman, and set her before the Lord, in the implication is in the tabernacle or in the temple later on. The priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it in the water. And then this is the important verse. The priest shall set the woman before the Lord, and then this word, ufara, the woman's hair. And then we go on and she has to drink the bitter waters. So the question is, what is ufara? Not clear. The root pei resh ayin has several meanings. It can mean to let go, to let alone, to unbind, to let loose. So it could be uncovering the hair or uncovering the head, not the same thing. Or it could be unplaiting or untying the hair. That's disheveling the hair. But the rabbis decided it meant uncover. And they deduced from this is that the priest is ordered to uncover the woman's hair, then her hair must be covered in the first place. There is also an added assumption there that she's not covering it because she's in the holy place, but that she has it covered all the time. So that's an unspoken assumption that the rabbis are making, possibly because they're living in a society where respectable women do cover their heads. The Mishnah introduces two new concepts, Dat Moshe, the law of Moses, and Dat Yehudit, Jewish law. And discussing in Mishnah Ketubot, discussing women who can be divorced without getting their ketubah money, she who transgresses Dat Moshe, and Dat Yehudit, and then they have to give instances. What cases fall under Dat Moshe? A woman who gives her husband untithed food, which is breaking a Torah commandment. A woman who has her sexual relations with her husband when she's nida, that's breaking a Torah commandment. A woman who doesn't separate challah, breaking a Torah commandment. And a woman who swears an oath and doesn't fulfill it, breaking a Torah commandment. So those are all, that's a common factor. These are all mitzvot from the Torah. What cases come under Dat Yehudit? A woman who goes out with her head parua, it's in that same word, it's taken from there. A woman who spins in the marketplace and a woman who speaks with every man. Now, these are not Torah commandments, as you can see. And I think you might be a little bit surprised at the idea that, you know, if you're a chatty person who talks with men who address you, you might be liable for divorce and not be paid your ketubah. That would be quite a surprise in the modern context. So the Dat Yehudit category seems to be accepted community custom rather than biblical law. And some rabbis have maintained that change in Dat Yehudit is possible over time, depending on the time and the place and the custom. And some would not accept that Dat Yehudit can change. The Talmud then reverses all this. You know, now we sorted out, oh, well, this is Torah prohibitions and this seems to be socially based customs. The Talmud in Ketubot says, no, the obligation to cover the head, not hair, at least minimally or symbolically, is biblical. Based on that interpretation we saw of the Sota verse already. And the details of how you cover hair are under Dat Yehudit. So that's a completely different interpretation of the Mishnah. So what's also interesting is both these texts are dealing with married women and nothing is said about single women and what they should be doing. And the other text from the Talmud that has implication for covering hair or head, this is from Brachot, Rabbi Isaac said, a hand's breadth of anything exposed in a woman constitutes erva, something that should not be seen except by people very close to you, like husbands. Rabbi Sheshet said, there's a whole list of bits of women that should not be seen. And then it ends with Rabbi Sheshet said, a woman's hair is erva, as it says, your hair is like a flock of goats, which is a verse from Shir HaShirim. It is not immediately clear what the Shir HaShirim verse has to do with anything. The word arev comes somewhere else in the verse, saying your voice is pleasant. Arev, erva, so it's a little bit odd. Erva usually means something like nakedness or shameful nakedness. Again, in the context in Brachot, the discussion is about women covering hair when their husbands are saying Shema and not walking around with uncovered hair in front of them. And this gets, this does seem to apply to any woman, whether married or not. And this gets expanded in the history of Jewish law. And you can see they're quite ambiguous texts. They need interpretation as to how you're going to apply them. And it's not clear, is this a biblical rule or a customary rule? Married women, single women, are there exemptions? What head, hair, all this needs to be teased out and definitely is in quite contrasting directions by later rabbis. So Rambam, for instance, who lived in an Islamic society where people are very covered up, thinks that it's not enough to cover your hair. You have to wear a sort of thing like a chador. You should be wearing a large veil over your entire person. And if you don't do that, you can be divorced. He also says that unmarried women have to cover their hair. And this leads down to Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who thinks that unmarried women should be covering their hair when they're praying and learning. Yosef Karo says all Jewish women, married or single, should cover their hair in public. But he doesn't say this is biblical law. He says this is Dat Yehudit, it's customary law. And you get differences. You get Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe, a major 16th, 17th century authority in Bohemia and Poland, saying, well, it depends. Depends what your local society is doing. A few 20th century rabbis have also taken that line, including Yosef Mashash, who used to be the chief rabbi of Morocco in the 1960s. And he says it absolutely depends on social context. Thus, it is stated, the matter depends entirely on practice, on minhag. Thus today, when all the women of the world have negated the previous practice, it is simply allowable to uncover their heads. This reflects no lack of modesty. And of course, you will hear different opinions. So the answer is, well, it depends who you ask, basically. The original sources are the same, but the interpretations vary enormously. If we just take the example of wigs, scheitels, very interestingly, they were completely forbidden by everyone for ages. So here we have the Chazan Sofer, major figure. I forbid women to wear a wig, a total prohibition. We have, if we want to go to the Sephardi world, Rabbi Abuchatzera, the Baba Sali from Morocco. Any woman wearing even a piece of a wig prepares herself fuel that will burn her in hell. Rabbi Eliashiv, who used to be very, very prominent in Israel, the wigs that women wear today are a total and complete prohibition. Rabbi Avod Yosef, there are over 20 poskim who say it's forbidden, absolutely forbidden to wear a wig and go outdoors. Heretics are the ones who allow it. That might surprise you, because scheitels are usually associated with the Haredi area of the population. Ah, but there are some people for. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, wearing a scheitel has a beneficial impact on children and grandchildren, not quite sure how, okay, livelihood and health. It is easy to take off a kerchief, which is not the case with a scheitel. So even in the matter of wearing scheitels, you can see there has been huge dissension. And if you talk to women who do cover their hair, especially people who've returned to the practice, Balot Tshuva, who maybe not didn't come from a family background, and you ask them why they do it, and there's a wonderful book called Hide and Seek, which is about women's hair covering, published by Urim Publications. I can't remember her first name. Somebody Schreiber published it. And she did a survey, and she found all sorts of reasons. Things like obedience to God's law. That's people who understood it to be a biblical prohibition to show your hair when you're married. Conformity to local or family practice, fear of people saying you weren't religious, desire to please God. One woman told her, well, the rabbis say it's important. Commitment to one's husband, that came up quite a lot. You're reserving yourself for your husband, a gift for your husband. However, there were people who said, I don't have to fuss with difficult hair. Somebody was wearing it as a penance, a sort of tshuva for a former lifestyle. Somebody said it was a way to try out different hairstyles and enjoy them. Somebody thought it meant she was a serious Jew. Several people said, because my husband wants me to do it. Some people thought of it as a symbol of Jewish identity. One person even said she felt it was like a kippah for a man. So you can see the motivations and the reasons behind wearing a scheitel, never mind the halacha behind wearing a scheitel, is also very various. And we're going to discover parallels to all this as we look at the Islamic world and what happens there. So let's move over to Islam with that sort of tiny, very brief, standing on one leg sketch of what happens in the Jewish world. And the term for modesty or shyness is haya. And in Islam, as in Judaism, concepts of modesty apply both to men and women. Men must cover the area between waist and thigh. Both genders are expected to behave with restraint and respect for others and a constant sense of their relationship to God and the duties that God expects them to do. So modesty often is associated with a sense of shyness, bashfulness, humility, and very like tzniut in the Jewish world. And here is an early text, a hadith text, narrated by Abdullah ibn Umar. The prophet, Muhammad, passed by a man who was admonishing his brother regarding haya, regarding modesty, and was saying to him, you are very shy and I'm afraid that might harm you. On that, Allah's apostle, Muhammad, said, leave him, for haya is a part of faith. In other words, it's a good quality. Do not discourage your brother from doing this. So this idea of it being part of a good religious life is very, very prevalent. And haya also includes the feeling of shame if you displease God by doing something bad. So again, like tzniut, it is a much wider category than what you're wearing. But like tzniut, it tends to be the bit that gets focused on most is what women are doing with their dress and their hair. So again, it's quite a parallel shift there from an all-encompassing concept that applies to both genders to one that gets associated with females. So we'll go back to the beginning. We'll look at some of the classic texts and see what happened with them and you know, what can be deduced from those original texts. The word that's usually used, hijab, comes from a root meaning to cover or to conceal. And it only occurs in the Quran in a context that's talking about a curtain between the wives of the prophet and some visitors. So in the Quran, the actual word hijab doesn't appear to relate to dress, much more a sort of a room division. But there are other words that appear in the Quran that do seem to be linked to clothing. There are not very many of them, and they are rather ambiguous, a bit like our Sota text with the parua hair. Like, what is that? So here is the classic one from chapter 24 of the Quran. Prophet, tell believing men to lower their glances and guard their private parts. That is purer for them. God is well aware of everything they do. And tell believing women that they should lower their glances, guard their private parts, and not display their charms, and there's much dispute about what charms means, beyond what ordinarily shows. They should let their headscarves, and we'll see that the word khimar is slightly disputed, fall to cover their necklines, another word we're going to need to look at, and they should not reveal their charms except to their husbands, their fathers, their husbands' fathers, their sons, their husbands' sons, their brothers, their brother's sons, their sister's sons, their womenfolk, their slaves, such men as attend and who have no sexual desire, that could mean eunuchs, or children who are not yet aware of women's nakedness. And the word for nakedness is awra, which is etymologically connected to erva. Same concept. They should not stamp their feet so as to draw attention to any hidden charms. Believers, all of you, turn to God so that you may prosper. So we have a list of people you don't have to cover up, which is actually much more extensive than the list of people in certainly traditional Judaism that you don't have to cover up. These relations are known as the mahram relations, and these relations are people you can be alone with. So you can be alone with brothers and brothers' sons and, you know, close and slaves come to that. And you don't need to cover up in front of them, according to the Quran. So you see that awra is very like erva. It's this part of a male or female that shouldn't be seen by other people or only by very restricted others. There's no awra between married people, for instance. You know, they don't have to cover up from each other. A man's awra is waist to knee. A woman's awra depends. In front of mahram, it's either the same as men or some people say shoulder to knee. It depends who you ask. In front of non-mahram relations, in other words, like everybody else in the world, generally everything except face and hands are considered they should be covered. Here we have differences between some of the legal schools we mentioned in our session about different legal schools in Islam. The Hanafis say you can have bare feet. Feet don't matter. They're not part of awra. Some people, particularly Salafi movements, would say face and hands are awra, which is why you will sometimes see women wearing niqab, wearing a face veil, and also with black gloves on. But again, that's only one chunk. That's only one particular, not even one of the major law schools. That's a modern movement that tends to go in that direction. And I don't think there's any evidence that pre-modern Muslim women wore gloves. I just don't think they did. Interestingly, women are not allowed to cover their faces when they perform the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. So that's quite interesting, because that sort of seems to be the reverse of what you would expect. And it perhaps argues that, again, that modesty is socially determined rather than being an absolute religious value. Interestingly, liberal interpreters of the Quran would say that this verse about letting headscarves fall to cover necklines probably only refers to breasts and genitals and doesn't matter about the rest of it, really, because in pre-Islamic Arabia, women were wandering around with not very much on. Again, I don't know how much proof we have of this. But again, it depends who you ask. And that word khimar is sometimes, it's often used in modern Arabic to mean a headscarf. But again, interpretation is disputed. And the word jaib, or the plural juyub, is literally the neckline of a dress, but it's often understood or translated as breast. So it's, in that uncovering, understanding will be you have to cover the top part of your body. More strictly, no, you have to cover your neckline. That's a sort of different interpretation. So it's quite difficult to know what the original text meant, just like it is with the Torah. Another important verse is this one from Quran 33. Prophet, tell your wives, your daughters, and women believers to make their outer garments, and the word here is jilbab, hang low over them. We'll get to the footnote in a moment, so as to be recognized and not insulted. God is most forgiving, most merciful. And the footnote, interestingly, says the Arabic idiom, atna al-jibab, means make it hang low, not wrap around, as other translators have assumed. And that has implications practically. Something that hangs low, could be loose and what have you. Wrap around might be a much more all-encompassing way of covering up. So that depends very much, again, on the interpretation. Now, jilbab itself can be used in modern Arabic to mean a sort of one of those coats that goes all the way down to the ground. But not everyone would agree that's what it originally meant by any means. First of all, they didn't have coats like that in ancient Arabia. And a lot of the verses here can be used in different ways. So the idea of making outer garments hang low over them can be taken to mean you should veil your face. Make your outer garment hang low over your face and the rest of you. Whereas others would say, no, it doesn't mean that at all. And that was not the original intent. So as in Judaism, we saw there were all these rather ambiguous texts that give rise to differing interpretations. It's very much the same thing in Islam. And then we have a last relevant Quranic verse. And this is really about all the verses in the Quran that deal with this subject. We can see it's not very many. No blame will be attached to elderly women who are not hoping for sex. Some people translate that as not hoping for marriage. If they take off their outer garments without flaunting their charms, but it is preferable for them not to do this. God is all hearing, all seeing. So outer garments seem to be connected with sexual availability and the need to counter that male desiring gaze. And all ladies are presumed to be exempt from that. They're past it. They don't need to cover up so much. And again, in modern Muslim societies, there are societies where older ladies don't cover themselves so much. They won't go to the length that younger women will because, who's going to look at me? So again, that can have practical implications. You notice also that the Quran says it's preferable for them to cover, but doesn't say it's mandatory either. So there seems to be perhaps a degree of self-determination in deciding in what you do implied by the Quran. So that's our first layer of text. That's Quranic text, which, as we know, are the most important text. But as you can see, as we said, they're a bit ambiguous. This means that the moment you get into the interpretative level, it can go every direction. And that is often guided or shaped by other considerations, social considerations, political considerations, theological considerations. Okay, so what about the next level of important texts, the hadith? We said before that there is a sort of science of hadith, the narrative chains, X said that Y said that Z said that P said, it's called the silsila, the chain. And those are examined very carefully. Do they match up? Did this person actually ever meet this person? Do we know that? Do we not know that? And also the hadith is stronger if there are multiple instances of that hadith with sort of kosher chains. Weak hadiths have iffy chains that have breaks in them or that are impossible because, person X never met person Y, or there's only one chain that authenticates a hadith. So interestingly, this hadith, which is constantly quoted, is actually a very weak hadith, but that doesn't stop it being quoted. Let's look at this. Abu Dawood has transmitted on the authority of Aisha, the prophet's wife, that Asma, the daughter of Abu Bakr, who was Aisha's sister, once came to the prophet, peace be upon him, wearing transparent clothes. The prophet, peace be upon him, turned his face away from her and told her, Asma, when a woman reaches puberty, nothing should be seen of her except this and this. And he pointed to his face and hands. So for many people, that is an absolute solid base. For other people, that's a very iffy hadith and you can't actually rule from it. So once again, we're in the realm of interpretation. And as we all know, I think from Judaism, it's not just Islam, people very often cherry pick texts to base a preconceived viewpoint. You look for the text that supports your point of view. That's not unusual at all. So because there is a textual basis that can be interpreted in quite a strict way, I would say that most women who do wear hijab do believe that it is prescribed by the Quran and the Hadith, no matter what other segments of the Muslim community might believe. But most people who observe it think, yes, that's something I have to do, very much as most women in the Jewish world who say cover their hair and observe other norms of modest dressing will say, yes, it's a biblical commandment. And the rabbis all agree, even those we've seen, there is actually dissension among rabbis as to the interpretation of those ambiguous texts. So again, this is very, very similar. In the other direction, we've looked at basic texts. If we go to the modern period, I've brought quite a long text here, but it's interesting because it shows you how scholars from the liberal end of the Muslim community would interpret hijab and how they would rule. And they would say that hijab is not what is usually commonly understood from the Quran. It's much more situational and much more on context. And they would look also to what is the purpose of hijab, and the way it's observed, does it actually fit that purpose and fulfill that purpose? They would be much more interested about trying to trace the exact meaning of words, and they would also be interested in context. So, for instance, is the Quran only talking about Muhammad's wives, or is the Quran talking about all women? We need to get that clear before we start ruling on the basis of these texts. So I've quoted Khaled Abu al-Fadl several times before, because he's a very good example of a modern liberal Muslim who is very well known, quite authoritative, and that publishes a great deal. So he was asked a she'ela, you know, a question about hijab, and this is his answer, this is his fatwa. And again, it's exactly like our response in literature. You ask the expert a question and he tells you what he thinks. So he lives in America, so he's talking about an American context. He says, in my opinion, hijab in this country, America, is clearly not a farad, an obligation, we'd say a chiyuv. And no sin is acquired for failing to wear the hijab. The reason for this position is that the ilah, we have a concept in Judaism like this, which is very similar, is ilah in Aramaic, the underlying reason for something, the operative cause for hijab, was to protect women from harm and to avoid bringing undue attention to them. In the United States, hijab often results in the exact opposite. In other words, bringing undue attention to a Muslim woman and heightening the risk of harm. To say the least, in my opinion, hijab is not at the core of the Islamic faith and not the kind of arguable duty that would be worth risking one's safety for. If a woman does wear a hijab in the West and harm does come to her, that gives me serious pause, meaning I'm troubled by the fact that the very purpose of the possible rule is now completely contravened. At the time of the Prophet, hijab was not raised as a topic until a year before the Prophet's death, meaning that many Muslim women worked on their iman, their faith, their belief for 10 and in some cases 15 years before they even had to think about the matter of hijab. What I'm saying is that especially when it comes to converts or people who have not been practicing Muslims for most of their lives and then decide to become religious, first work on aqidah, on creed, on issues of belief. Your iman, your faith in God. You can hear it's cognate to emunah. Your understanding of the wisdom and purpose of Islam before you start delving into the legalities of hijab or no hijab. My humble opinion is that the matter of hijab of a Muslimah, a Muslim woman, in this day and age has become of a highly exaggerated importance. So it's quite interesting what he's doing here. He's situating the original Quranic text in a particular time. He notes that those verses that we've looked at are dated too late in the Prophet's career. It wasn't the first thing he wanted to say to the women in his community. It was the last thing or it was near the end of what he wanted to say to them. So it can't be that central. He also says that the operative cause behind it is the protection of women. And if wearing hijab causes you harm, then it is not fulfilling its original purpose and shouldn't wear hijab in the context where it will bring you into danger. And that sort of reasoning you can sometimes find in some of the progressive movements in Judaism, arguing about original context, for instance, for kashrut and some things like that, and saying it doesn't apply anymore. And the original purpose was to do X, and that doesn't apply anymore. So again, there are different positions taken by people in different parts of both communities using some very, very similar reasoning, which I find absolutely fascinating, actually. And so there is debate in the Muslim world, especially in the West, where you don't have the added factor where in many, many Muslim countries, it's completely the norm for women to wear hijab and nobody thinks twice about it. It's not an issue. Whereas in the West, you've got to make a decision. Are you going to stick out like a sore thumb and maybe risk people, you know, throwing things at you. I once went into my bank and there was a nice Muslim clerk there who usually wore hijab, and I didn't recognize her because she wasn't wearing it. And I was a bit worried the bank had put pressure on her. So I asked her and I said, you know, did the bank people tell you to stop wearing it? And she said, no, I'm pregnant and I got attacked near a tube station. And my husband said, no, you've got to take it off because we can't have you being attacked. You can't have you, you know, she was wrestled to the ground and hit. And he said, no, it's a safety issue. You can't wear hijab anymore. And not, certainly not when you're pregnant, which, you know, horrified me. But again, you can see that there are situations in which Muslims have to make very difficult decisions, which they might not have to make in majority Muslim societies. Okay, so what action types are there? And I think we should nip down to the chart. There are different sorts and they have different names. So this is called a shaila. It's just a loose scarf that many women in Pakistan and India wear very traditionally. Usually hijab is often reserved for a slightly more tightly wrapped thing that covers the neck and sort of is fastened. This Amira style goes over the shoulders. Khimar is a much looser thing that comes down more or less to your belly button. Again, these are modern terms. Chador, which is used by Shiite women, particularly in Iran, is an enormous piece of black cloth or flowered if you're a little girl, which annoyingly has no fastening. So you have to clutch it to you with one hand the whole time, which I think drives people mad. There are pictures of women holding chador in their teeth when they've got to have both hands free. Niqab is the term for a face veil. And burqa, which in this form is mostly Afghanistan and sort of that area, is this enveloping single garment with a mesh to see out of. So all these come under the general heading of hijab, but they have very, very different cultural contexts, and you find them in different places. And just as, for instance, different styles of Hasidic dress carry messages for people who live in that community, and they'll know if you're satmar or babov or bells by, you know, do you wear a hat on top of your wig, or, you know, you're wearing this color clothing, or there are messages, sociological messages that are very much conveyed by different types of hijab. And people read each other, you know, again, a bit like wearing kippah or not wearing kippah. Is it a black kippah or a large kippah or a small kippah, or has it got your name around it? Or is it one of those ones you pick up at a bar mitzvah with, you know, glitzy, you know, souvenir of excess bar mitzvah? They all imply things about your religious positioning and your level of frumkeit. Same with hijab. So people read each other very, very closely in many ways like that. The other thing, this is just head coverings. The other thing that has developed in the modern period and really doesn't date back before the 20th century is what is called zi-shari. In other words, it's like halachic dress, sharia dress. And that is the sort of thing that you see. It's sort of rather anonymous, long coat, beige, grey, pale colours. And headscarf tucked into it. Now, that is not a traditional ethnic dress. And in all sorts of places, traditional Muslim women's dress was very, very different from the shalwar kameez, the tunic and loose trousers with a dupatta, a sort of loose veil thrown in various ways over your head, to little embroidered caps in Hunza up in, where's Hunza? It's sort of, I think it's in part of Pakistan. Stiffened leather masks for the face in parts of the Gulf. Bedouin women who have long veils with beads and things sewn on them. Turkmen women who wear boots and embroidered coats and have all sorts of simple caps and loosely tied scarves and metal headdresses for posh events. So the traditional range of Muslim dress is enormously various, absolutely differs all around the world. But this modern zi-shari, this sort of, you know, sharia dress, is absolutely monolithic, and you can see it anywhere where people are sort of, it's associated a bit with the equivalent of the Balchuva movement. So newly religious people tend not to wear what grandma wore. You can see this in Jerusalem. The old ladies are still wearing the beautiful embroidered dresses and a white loose veil that goes over a cap. The younger, more pious women are wearing zi-shari, wearing the long coats and the tightly wrapped headscarf, and they've abandoned this traditional dress. So there are also all sorts of messages about modernization and, again, you know, what stream of Islam or what style of Islam you adhere to. And it's very complex socially. The West just sees hijab and doesn't tend to distinguish between different types. So we have all this variation. We also have, by the way, a whole load of new fashion houses that produce very, very beautiful modern clothing that conforms with these notions of hijab, and there's some very expensive and posh Paris type creations out there. And again, I don't know, you know, everyone's living in different places. You will also have seen women dressed in black from head to toe with a niqab and gloves on. They're usually from the Gulf, or they might possibly be Salafis. But again, you wouldn't see that sort of dress in traditional Pakistani villages, for instance. You just wouldn't see that at all. And there are varying attitudes to this. The Pew Research Center, which is very good, American-based, I think it does surveys all over the world, looked at different types of style of dress. And they asked about 2,000 people across the Muslim world, what style of dress is appropriate for women in public? And they recorded the percentage of people they asked who said women are dressed most appropriately, you know, which style. So it goes from the burqa on the left to uncovered hair on the right, and with the various variations between. So if you look at this, you can see that the most acceptable one is actually more or less the middle one. It's just a standard hijab of zishari, that sort of thing. Note, however, when you look down at Saudi Arabia, you've got a very high ranking there. 63% think that niqab is the most appropriate thing. But if you look at the completely non-hijab wearing woman on the right, you notice that in Lebanon, 49% of people asked thought that was the most appropriate way for a woman to appear in public. That's partly because Lebanon is also a partly Christian country. But you can see that these numbers vary enormously around the Muslim world. If you look at the burqa, look at the median number down the bottom, it's pretty low. It's only 2%. It is very much an Afghani thing. And you can see that the area, they didn't ask the Afghans, but you can see that the Saudi Arabians were the most favorable to the complete burqa, which goes quite well with the fact that their preferred version is number two, the niqab. So you can see there that it varies from cultural context about what people think. And this is only a sample of about 2,000 people. You know, if you actually introduced more variants and looked at more countries, you would find it varying more too. So it's important to realize it's not a monolithic thing, and not everyone actually agrees on it by any means. And some people, some people are dead against all forms of hijab. Okay, so what about in the West? Because in the West, it becomes a focus that sort of drowns a lot of other things out, and it certainly drowns women's voices out a lot. And there's a lot of controversy and fear, for instance, in France particularly, where, you know, that laws have been passed to stop women wearing face veils and wearing hijab of any sort, for instance, at school. A lot of it is also to do with fear and unfamiliarity. You know, this person looks different from me and I don't fancy that at all. Very often people assume things. They assume that women are forced to wear it. And there are two main reasons here. The sort of traditional view that Islam is something other and exotic and a bit threatening, and we don't know much about it. And also, of course, there is feminist discourse that says hijab is oppressive, full stop, without, again, necessarily asking women what they thought. And we've got quite a few factors here. We've got the legacy of colonialism. We've got a still very prevalent idea in the West that the West is superior in all ways, and that non-Western practices are primitive and backward and inferior, and progress is when you adopt Western customs. And interestingly, that used to be applied to Jews. The Jewish question of the 19th century was all about how to get the Jews out of their backward primitive ways and make them assimilate into modern civilization and stop being different. It is very much that same discourse. And just as back then nobody was interested in learning about Jewish culture and its highlights and its ancient tradition, it's pretty much true in the West. A lot of people are very uninterested in learning anything about Islam. You know, it's just they're different. They're not Arsenal, they're all backward and they're primitive and they treat their women badly. So one of the good things about having a course like this is we can all learn more about this and sort of get a bit more subtle with our ideas. People often make assumptions. They often see Muslims as one monolithic whole who are all exactly the same. That, of course, happens in the Jewish world. People look at the Orthodox. And, you know, they're all the same, whether they're wearing a black hat in Meir Shearim or they're a modern Orthodox, they're all the same, you know, Orthodox Jews, and people lump us together. And we often don't care for that very much either. And of course, that's not helped by the fact that a lot of Muslim apologists are presenting their own particular variety of Islam as the only authentic one. And that discourse of authenticity, again, that's something that we have to think about too. We get that from Judaism as well. If we look at Muslim rights, concepts of the rights of women in Muslim law, it's actually remarkably similar to halakha. So, for instance, Islamic law allows women to retain control of their property after marriage, as does halakha. I have to tell you that in Britain, married women did not have the right to own their own property till 1870, with the passing of the Married Women's Property Act. And before that, when you got married, your husband automatically had legal claim to everything you owned, including the clothes on your back. So again, some of these assumptions that the West is much more progressive aren't always true, both in relation to Judaism and in Islam. When you get on to thinking about the colonial period, a lot of the colonizers thought that people they were colonizing were distinctly inferior and very backward and primitive. But what also happened was the native elites who were sort of co-opted by the colonizers in helping to administrate and run these various countries, often internalized that view and despised their own country, culture, and tried to adopt Western ways and ideas. And dropping the hijab was one of those ways of signaling that you were on the side of the West and you were progressing in a nice Western way. And it became quite a class issue. And there's this wonderful book by Catherine Bullock, which I recommend, Rethinking Muslim Women in the Veil. And she says, unveiling became a central urgency for elites attempting to catch up with the West. Thus the veil, again, you know, all of them, it's the veil, no differentiation at all, became a potent symbol of the progress or regress of a nation. And since it was the upper classes leading modernization, the anti-veil discourse was also an attack on those lower classes that remained attached to the veil in its older symbolic meanings, a symbol of piety or maybe wealth, because you could afford to, you know, keep your women, you know, they didn't have to work so hard so they could wear veils. The anti-veil discourse opened a gulf between the people of a nation. The Western-focused elites and others who were adopting the culture of the colonizer, as well as benefiting economically and socially from colonialism, versus the rest, lower classes, traditional Muslim teachers, and others, who, as well as suffering from colonialism, were not adapting or assimilating to Western ways. And it wasn't just colonizers. A lot of nationalist secular states in the early and mid-20th century also carried out anti-hijab campaigns. Turkey, for instance, under Kemal Atatürk, and to some extent, Iran under the Shah, where you have Muslim rulers banning hijab. Atatürk, from 1923 on, would not allow women wearing hijab to go to public institutions, and that included schools and universities and courts and parliament and the civil service and the medical institutions. If you wore hijab, you couldn't be part of those. And, you know, that's not a colonial imposition, that's an internal imposition. And the Shah of Iran banned the veil in 1935. And there were riots. Tunisia in 1989 passed a law banning government workers and school university students from wearing hijab because they were trying to clamp down on an Islamic revival at the time. And none of these bans were started by women. They were all started by men who were looking for control of state and society. So it wasn't equivalent at all to, you know, bra burning in the West or something like that. This was male initiated and many women were quite resentful. Feminists in the West have also had trouble understanding why there's actually been a rise in hijab wearing in many of these countries, often among younger, well-educated women whose mothers might not have worn hijab. So what are they doing? You know, why are they freely of their own choice asking to wear hijab? This is often attributed to false consciousness or women being oppressed, but they don't actually listen to what women are saying. We're going to look at what women are saying in a bit, but quite often women see it as a form of empowerment for various reasons that we'll look into in a moment. There are also competing views in the Muslim world. There are traditionalists who say, well, that's it. You know, that's the Sharia. You have to cover up. We can't change anything. There are also modernists of various types, including Islamic feminists, who try to build on or develop or alter or re-look at classical Islamic law and reinterpret it. And I would say Khaled Abul Fadl, who we just read, is an example of that. They might look at different verses of the Quran and trying to reinterpret. You also have the modern movements like the Salafis, we talked about, the very strict pietists who just back to the Quran, ignore the Middle Ages, and this very literal interpretation, ignoring everything that ever came afterwards. So they're calling for the return to the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, and they tend to have a slightly ambivalent attitude towards the equality of the sexes. They want women to learn, but they also want women covered up and controlled. And then you have secular feminists, modernists, and they exist in the Islamic countries too, who believe in a Western-style secular liberalism and want to remove every aspect of Islamic law that doesn't conform to a secular liberal understanding of how women should be treated. And there's a whole movement in Iran called My Stealthy Freedom that publishes on Facebook videos of women taking off their hijab in Iran, which is quite a dangerous thing to do. And you know, it's on trains or sometimes in the privacy of their homes as a protest about not being given the choice. So what do women actually feel about it? Many women in the West have spoken about their desire to wear hijab and what it means to them in blogs and newspaper articles and TV interviews. But for most women in many Muslim countries, it's just natural. It's just what everybody wears. It's like wearing jeans in New York or London. You don't think twice about it. And it's something your society and family have just done and do, and it's not a big deal. We're not talking about countries that have laws that force women to wear hijab, which includes non-Muslim women. So, for instance, Jewish women in Iran have to wear hijab. They have to wear a chador and cover up. It applies to all women, whatever their religion. So the prime examples are Iran and Saudi Arabia. In Iran, as we said, many urban educated women don't want to wear hijab. And this is where that movement, My Stealthy Freedom, comes from. Often lower class rural women don't mind wearing hijab at all because that's what they did, their mums did. But elsewhere, whether women wear hijab because that's what everyone around them is doing, or because they've made a conscious decision to wear it for religious reasons, there are many, many meanings to hijab. And we'll just look at a few meanings. I've taken out a list here from Catherine Bullock's book. It has been worn as a revolutionary protest. So in Algeria, in the fight for independence, in the 1950s, women who had never worn hijab started wearing it as a protest to signal their opposition to the French colonial regime. And amazingly, when you look back at it from history, in the early days of the Iranian Revolution, a whole load of educated women, by that stage, only rural or really lower class women were wearing the chador, but a whole load of university women, educated women, started wearing the chador to protest the Shah. As part of the beginning of the revolution, before it got hijacked by the extreme religious, and you got the odd phenomenon of Marxist women and religious women both wearing chador as this anti-Shah symbol. So that, but nowadays this is sort of inconceivable, really, really peculiar. As well as revolutionary protest, you have more ordinary sort of political protest. After the Six-Day War defeat of Egypt, a lot of people lost confidence in secular nationalism. That's when the Islamic movement takes off in Egypt. And you get urban, educated, middle-class women who start wearing hijab, unlike their mums, often shocking their families. But again, what they're wearing is zishari. It's this standardized modern invention. They're not wearing what their grandmas meant or what lower-class rural women would wear. And actually, lower-class rural women in Egypt tend to wear long, flowery dresses and a sort of quick headscarf knotted at the back of their necks. You know, they're out in the fields working. They can't wear all this coat and wraparound stuff. They die of heat. So these Egyptian-educated women wanted to protest poor leadership and reject immoral behaviour and gain God's favour for their country and their society again. And hijab symbolised that very much. You then, of course, have the religious motivation. A lot of people, it's a bit like the Baal Tshuva movement. There are a lot of people who've returned to religion in the Islamic world, and they want to please God, and they want to do what Sharia says, and they believe that hijab is actually essential. They wouldn't agree with Khaled Abul Fadl at all. And they feel that they're showing that they're truly Muslim. And very often it's younger women who are very critical of their parents. And they want to make society better. They also believe that hijab levels social classes and it promotes morality. So there's the religious idea. I wouldn't call it cynical, but a more economically based thing is in some Muslim countries, wearing hijab means you can go on working as a woman. So in Egypt, often low income urban dwellers who've only been there for in the city for a couple of generations might be the first people in the family to be educated, and they often work in government offices. And they've got an interest in wearing hijab because if they can claim a religious right for their husbands to support them and keep their income for themselves. And also if they have traditional family don't want them working when they get married, they can say, well, I'll wear hijab. It solves the problem. I'm showing that I'm a correct, proper, traditional woman, and you can trust me to go out. It's also seen as a sort of guarantee. If you're working, you have to come late. Hijab assures your family and neighbours that you're respectable. You haven't been acting naughty things. No. She looks very from, so you don't get this sort of gossip and stuff. It's a visual sign that you're very good. If the family object to a daughter going to university, if she wears hijab, they may trust her much more. So it can be quite useful in some ways. It can also combat male harassment. And any of you who've been to the Middle East, including Israel, know that men are somewhat more unrestrained, should we say. So women often say that they stop being sex objects if they're wearing hijab. Men think twice before they touch them or say inappropriate things, a bit like nuns, really. And it can give women a sense of power or self-esteem. Granted, it puts the onus on women, but until men can be re-educated, it certainly protects women to some extent. In the West in particular, it's an expression of personal identity. It says you're a proud Muslim, a bit like wearing your kippah in the street with pride. Or maybe it emphasizes your ethnic origin, if that's something you want to emphasize. And quite often, second generation immigrants start wearing hijab against their parents' wishes. There was a wonderful example, a book I read about Salafi women in London, where an Afro-Caribbean woman who I think had started wearing niqab. And her father was so cross, he cut it up. And actually, I think she started hiding it outside the house so she could get out the house and put it on without her dad knowing, which is a bit surprising. Sometimes it's a differentiation from your parents. They're just cultural Muslims. I am a from religious Muslim, could be like that. There are also social status things. We saw in Egypt that it's associated with the middle classes in cities. It's one way of saying, I'm not one of those peasants. I wear proper hijab, I wear the zishari, I wear this uniform thing. I'm not one of those peasant women with their flowery dresses at all. So it can be a way of moving your social position up. And then again, we have what we talked about before, custom. Basically, this is not a sinister pressure or force. It's just the norm in your society. Women wear some form of head covering, and that's what they do. Nobody thinks twice about it. Somebody did a study of women in Yemen, and they found that some women wore face veils and some didn't. Those who didn't said it got in the way and they didn't feel it meant anything. Some felt that it protected them from a male gaze. So even within that one society, people are wearing or not wearing things for many different reasons. And there are also quite a bit of change over time. So women in Oman had a traditional leather face mask. They usually started wearing it when they got married. But the very top and the bottom layer of society didn't. And it sort of seems to have fizzled out. Some husbands made their wives stop wearing it. They felt it was old fashioned and primitive. They wanted modern wives. So they wouldn't let them wear these traditional leather masks. So perhaps go to niqab or some other form at all. A lot of Saudi women are very happy with niqab. They feel protected. They feel it's their culture. They feel as long as they've got access to education and employment, they honestly don't mind. And because Saudi Arabia is very segregated, you can often take it off at work because it's only other women. You're working in a women's bank or a women's university and you don't have to wear it there. So it's a very complex and varied phenomenon. It's very dangerous to generalize about hijab. It means many things to many different people, very much like various forms of covering do in Judaism as well. And when we understand the reasons or even some of them behind choosing to wear hijab, especially if you actually meet and talk to women who are wearing hijab, it should be easier to move away from this sort of unquestioning acceptance of stereotypes and assumptions, what we all have, and to find out what real people think and what they actually do. And I well remember doing some scriptural reasoning with a couple of women wearing niqab. And at first I couldn't see anything except the face veil. And as we went on and we talked, I couldn't see the face veil anymore because I was listening to them and they became people to me. And I could also, well, as we've all learned to do during COVID, I could also see expression in their eyes. which is an interesting byproduct of COVID. I now feel I can read people behind masks much better than I could before. And that happens with people wearing niqab too. It doesn't have to be a barrier. As in all these things, if you talk to people, you'll find they are people, whatever they are wearing. So we'll just end with a couple of quotes from Muslim women who are expressing what they feel about it. So here's a 17-year-old. When people ask me if I feel oppressed, I can honestly say no. I made this decision out of my own free will. I like the fact that I am taking control of the way other people perceive me. I enjoy the fact that I don't give anyone anything to look at, and that I have released myself from the bondage of the swinging pendulum of the fashion industry and other institutions that exploit females. That's quite a good feminist reason for wearing hijab, as I believe. Here's another woman from London this time. I have a friend who dresses really provocatively. She would wear close to nothing. So she's put this on, and if she got a reaction from a man, she'd say, good, I'm looking fine. She'd really question if these men weren't gawking at her. That's pathetic, right? That's how you judge your beauty, by the reactions of men? What Muslim women, and especially Muslim women who cover, are automatically saying is, I don't care what you think of me. You shouldn't make a judgment if I'm attractive or not. I don't establish my worth or my beauty by your reaction, only by the reaction of Allah, God. And two more interesting ones. Here's another Londoner. I did have a choice. If you're not going to wear it for the sake of Allah, what's the point? Nobody ever forced me to do it. I did it on my own. There was a choice. Then a rather poignant memory of somebody from Iran. And this is the traditional, this is what happened to traditional women when the Shah outlawed the veil. When the Shah outlawed the veil, he let it be known that the heads of all society families like ours risked his serious displeasure if they did not show their wives in public and in Western garb. When my mother learned she was to lose the age-old modesty of her veil, she was beside herself. My father realized, however, that he didn't dare but disobey. For a Persian aristocrat to allow strange men to gape at his wives in public was shameful in the extreme. He sent to the Avenue Le Lazare for hats for all his wives and told them that the next day they were to put them on and ride with him in the open drosky. To my mother, it was exactly as if he had insisted that she parade naked in the street. And I think that gives you some sort of sense of the fact that there are all sorts of different understandings and meanings. It doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. Some Muslim women hate the veil and don't want to wear it. Some feel it empowers them. Some feel it's the marker of their relationship with God. So I think we should take it on a person-by-person basis. I think we should listen to what women have to say. I don't think anyone would advocate forcible pressure on women to veil, and that does happen in some societies and some places too. But it's a complex phenomenon. We need to think about it with care in both the Jewish and the Islamic context and listen to what people have to tell us about why they're doing things. Okay, let's have a look at the questions. Ooh, lots of questions this time. Is the issue type of dress appropriate culturally or choice? Well, yes, that's very much the whole thing. You know, it depends on your context, your social context, and what everyone else around you is doing it. And in the West, it becomes much more a matter of choice because the majority around you are not doing that. So you are in some way making a statement if you live in a non-Muslim society by wearing hijab, which you're probably not making the same statement if you're living in the middle of Pakistan and wearing hijab. It's a completely different thing. Somebody said, if I may note, here in the US, people are more respectful of Amish women's very visible modesty practices and actions as compared to the very similar practices and actions of Hasidic and Muslim women. Yes, and that should probably tell us something about the other fears that people have. The Amish are seen as a peaceable internal community that don't pose a threat, and Muslims are sometimes, and sometimes Jews, are seen as an external other community that does pose a threat in some way or other. So yes, it's fascinating. And I actually think the whole COVID thing with masks has shown up how much of our reactions to face masks are nothing to do with practicalities, or, you know, it's much more to do with perception of the other and fear and sometimes ignorance, that feeling that they're very, very sinister. And some Muslim women I knew were a bit ironic when masks mandates came, where they were saying, ha, you know, finally, and, you know, a couple of people saying, there you are, God didn't like people laughing at us in niqab and what have you, and I just made everyone wear a mask. And there was a certain sense of, yeah, we got something back there, which I could understand. What does the rabbi say about ancient Israel and the non-Jewish women there? Well, we have very little information about clothing of Israelite women. Occasionally there's a reference to Rivka, for instance, covers herself with a tsa'if, which in modern Hebrew is a scarf. What is a tsa'if in an ancient Israelite context? I have no idea. But the interesting thing is she wasn't wearing it until she saw Isaac, and then she covers herself. So what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, you only covered it when you were meeting your fiancé? It's very hard to know. We have Ruth, who takes her covering off, and Boaz loads it up with grains. So that doesn't sound as though she has to have it on all the time. It sounds as though it was customary to wear something on her head, but you could use it for other things. Very like Mexican women use various head coverings, as they also, you know, carry things in them, as, you know, used as carrying cloth. So we don't have an awful lot of information. The Tanakh doesn't seem to be interested in it. It certainly doesn't make any rules about it. So the rabbis had to work on that verse from Sota because there was nothing else, really. Somebody says, when I covered my hair with a scarf during a part of my marriage, I felt the female equivalent of castration. I have given up because I get terrible headaches and infected blisters on my scalp. Yes, many women find that. That book by, I think, Lynn Schreiber, that's right, Hide and Seek, records experiences like that. A woman who said, you know, I didn't really want to, or other women who said I was ambivalent about it, but in both cases said it did me so much physical damage that I either couldn't or just wanted to give it up because it really wasn't doing it for me. When I was first married, I lived in Israel, and I've always been a bit of a dovekinik, so I used to cover my hair if I was wearing trousers and not cover it if I was wearing a skirt, because I hated being put in a box, because I knew I just got on a bus and everyone went, oh, religious female, she's covering her hair and wearing a skirt, or, oh, totally secular female, she's wearing trousers, not covering her hair. So I just wanted to muddle up those categories a bit. After a while, I gave up because it was just too much work. Okay. Do the rabbis, ancient or modern, deal with these issues? Well, we talked about that a bit. They definitely talked about, again, it was very, very much, I think, formed by the society they were living in. Interesting, those who can see these women are just those prohibited in the Chumash. Well, yes, it's actually, you are prohibited to marry any of those mahram relations. But interestingly, they can see you not wearing your hijab. I doubt naked, because, you know, people have natural senses of modesty as well. Implies there's some danger in these relationships. Well, yes, in some, it's odd, isn't it? Because you could go two ways. You could say, well, the closer and more incestuous a possible relationship should be, the more it should be covered up. Or you could say, the more impossible it is to think of having a marriage relationship with these people, the more you can be casual about it. And that seems to be the direction that Islam goes in. The inner circle you can be freer with, because of course you can't get married to them. To protect the women from harm, so blame the victim. Yes, definitely, there is that aspect of it. In the Islamic world, it changes wearing items by government and degree rate around Iraq, Gaza. Yes, exactly. We talked about that a bit. Ilah in Hebrew, yes, sibar, reason for something. Yes, exactly. So it's very much like the Islamic concept. France is not mistaken, hijab prohibition for Pharisees. I'm sure. I think all public contexts, you can't wear hijab to school. I once saw a very sad video of a young woman who wanted to wear hijab, and was about 17, and she's walking to school and being interviewed as she walks, and as she gets to the school gate, she has to take her hijab off, and you can see it hurts her very much that she's not allowed to wear it at school. Jews aren't allowed to wear kippot in schools in France either, or any religious symbols whatsoever. Nobody is allowed to wear any religious symbol. We've got to think about laïcité, yeah. In Quebec, all religious symbols are banned for people working in public, including teachers. The ban includes kippot. Yeah, so that sounds very similar. I presume it's the French cultures are leaping over the ocean there. 11th April 2021. For all excluding scarves in France, yes. It makes it terribly hard, really, for people. You know, it just seems to be pointless to try and mandate what people can wear that's a religious symbol. You know, why? Cultural wars are some pushback justified, not in the specifics from the West. Indeed. What is the mainstream Islam position on non-wearers believing head covering? Is it more political stance? They're fine. You know, if you visit a mosque, it's only polite to put something over your head if that's what people in that mosque do. So I've been in the odd mosque and taken along some sort of tichel and put it on, you know, as I would if I went to shul, actually. And I think people are, you probably might get asked to put something over your head as a woman if you went into a mosque. They might probably very politely, and they might have a store, you know, a bit like at the Cotter, where there's a box with bits and pieces that people can use them. But yes, it would be only polite in a prayer context, or in a mosque, in a sacred place, it would only be polite to put something on your head, and people would understand that as respect. They wouldn't believe that they wouldn't think that you had to share their views. They would just see it as respectful. Also, taking off your shoes if you go into a mosque. Quebec has a law that forbids any person who wears a head covering and cannot work in a government employment. Yes, that sounds very like France. Faisal law is secularism, exactly like France. Interesting to note all the exclusions are symbols of God by secular government and also self-selection. Nuns, priests, rabbis, mullahs, yes, my mind immediately directed towards God when seeing at and about in a world super devoid of religious symbolism. Maybe this is why it is very threatening to secular regimes who feel that secularity is the absolute cornerstone of society, that you don't want religious symbols in public and in any context whatsoever. Then, of course, you get into questions of how far can the state interfere with the private and religious lives of its members. But that is the ongoing culture war, certainly in France and probably Quebec too. Symbols, but not necessarily actions, rave prophets and their criticism. I'm not quite sure if that's a question or a statement. Women Iran protesting rule of mullahs have unveiled their heads briefly as protests. Yes, that's the My Stealthy Freedom and other things too, because there are a lot of women. I imagine that most of these women say, well, if you want to wear chador, that's their business. But it should not be a legal requirement, just as it shouldn't be a legal requirement in France that you have to take all your religious symbols off. And, you know, they're both extremes. You know, everybody has to dress according to my definition of my religion, and nobody can dress according to their definition of their religion. So as in most things, I would go with Rambam and say the middle path is probably best. Quebec's an interesting case, as he went perhaps the most religious province, the leads rejecting Roman Catholicism, etc., less marriage, more living together, but openly say they want to protect their language, culture, etc., and have a say in immigration to the province. Yes, I suppose Quebec feels itself, and I don't know very much about Quebec, you'll all know much more than I do, I imagine it sees itself as a somewhat threatened minority in a majority society that has different language, different mores, different ways. So if you're a minority anywhere, and we know that as Jews, you tend to get a bit more protective about what you do. And that may actually make you much fiercer. You can see that in Haredi society. There's a dualism. Every object concept can be used obviously, indeed. Yes, that's the book I was referring to. Lynn Schreiber, Hide and Seek, Jewish Women in Hair Covering. Well worth a read. Thank you for nice things to say. Amish also Christians. Yes, do Amish tend to live in the countryside. They have their own agricultural communities. Naturally, amazing amounts of Amish, because like the Haredim, they have huge families. And there are also different groups of Amish, and they have different modesty rules. They don't all, there's the old Amish, and then there's this Amish, and that Amish, and the other Amish. And the culture varies quite a bit between the different groups, and some are much more traditional and fierce, and some are much more laid back. Rivka was not wearing the tzitzit in the presence of the slave, indeed, or maybe she wasn't wearing it because she was on a camel and it got in the way. It's interesting. It's not quite clear what the context is. The context is she's covering herself up when she sees her betrothed. So what was she doing the rest of the time? We don't know. So we haven't got all the bits of information. We've just got one little piece of information. And was she doing this because it was customary, or was she genuinely overcome and embarrassed, or was it a one-off? Or it seems to me that because it is mentioned, it's a significant, so it might not be something that was absolutely obvious. She may be going beyond social demands that the Tanakh actually notices her doing it. I'm not absolutely sure. Again, we have these very partial, fleeting references to how women dress and behave in Tanakh, and we don't have the whole picture. Yes, absolutely good point. On the other hand, Tamar covered up to pretend to be a kadesha, some sort of sacred prostitute. So there were societies where it was prostitutes who covered their heads. So again, a lot depends on the social context. Who would not cover their heads and parts of the feet in such hot regions? Again, there's that. It's said that traditional Bedouin clothing is quite effective at repelling heat. There's an interesting thing in the Islamic world where women wear black and men wear white traditionally. So that's I think you'd have to go into colour symbolism and look what's going on there. But that's what most of the Islamic world. Interesting, of course, in the Haredi world, everyone is now wearing black. It used to be only men who wore black, but women are increasingly in the Haredi world. The last 10 years, most adult women wear black now. girls sort of grey or maybe pastels, but if you look at photographs of rabbis, Haredi rabbis before the war, you can see their wives wearing actually quite short sleeves, flowery dresses, and not all of them have got their heads covered. So it has changed over time, and the absolute prevalence of wigs now is a very modern thing. So this is when I was married in Israel, I covered my hair with wool slacks in the winter. Yes, a lot of kibbutz women actually would cover their hair and wear trousers or slacks. Would you categorize hijab as one of the Ten Commandments? Well, Islam doesn't have Ten Commandments. It doesn't have 613 commandments. Or an imam's rule or more of a cultural custom. Well, again, this is what we've been talking about. It depends who you talk to. If you talk to liberal modernists, they'll say it's culturally dependent, and what the prophet ordained for his might have been just for his wives, or it might have been a particular cultural context, and it might not apply now. And if we look at the underlying, what he calls the ilah, the underlying reason for this, it's protection. So if it doesn't protect you, then fine, don't wear it. It's not achieving its purpose. Others would say it's absent. No, that's it. You cover. There's a variety. We just spent the whole time talking about that. You know, it depends who you ask, and it depends on the social and cultural context very, very much. I think you could be not particularly from Muslim at all in Pakistan and still wear hair covering, because literally, you know, 99.99% of people, women around you, wearing head covering, wear a head covering. Malala Yousafzai, who's from Afghanistan. No, she's Pakistan, from northern Pakistan, near Afghanistan. She always appears in a sort of loosely draped scarf, which is what women in her part of Pakistan wear. She's just wearing her national dress. She's not really wearing hijab as hijab. She's wearing what the society she came from wears. And again, that's, you know, maybe I don't know if anyone's interviewed her, but for her, certainly part of that is cultural. So the interplay of cultural and religious factors is difficult to separate them out. What else people said? The issues of headaches, skin irritation while wearing our covering our rabbis. Well, yes, again, lots of women do report this. I gather wigs are terrible to your hair. You didn't speak much about the rest of their dress. Who wears full length women jeans and t-shirt with hijab? Again, it varies enormously. So in the West, I've seen in London, I see lots and lots of young Muslim women who are wearing jeans and just, you know, standard clothing, but are wearing hijab. Or I might see somebody wearing zishari who's got, you know, one of these kits down to the floor. Or I might see women who are clearly from the Gulf walking around department stores with full niqab and black everything, and, you know, sort of four or five of them, a little group with a man accompanying them. And they'll probably have come, as I say, from the Gulf. They won't be locals. I know women who have decided that it's just covering your hair, so they wear sort of turban-like things, but don't actually have anything under their chins. There are a million and one ways that people combine these things. I sometimes look at the hijabi fashion sites because they are just fascinating. There's one called Shukr, S-H-U-K-R. And I sometimes look on that, and that's quite a conservative one, but it's fascinating to see what they do with it. And also the way they represent the model. So they all have, you know, they don't show their faces. You know, they're just standing around beautiful places, but no faces. So it's quite interesting. Different mosques, if you pass different mosques, you'll see differently dressed people coming out of them. A lot of Muslim women will wear hijab for prayer. You know, they might be wearing jeans and what have you, but they might get into their mosque clothes. Again, like, you know, a lot of Jewish women don't cover their hair during the week, but might wear a hat or something on Shabbat and wear a skirt, whereas during the week they'll wear trousers. So that's not at all uncommon to have special prayer clothes or to have your mosque outfit, which will probably be much more covered up than your daily outfit. And people mix and match. People are influenced by their husbands. Sometimes people defy their husbands. Sometimes, you know, the husbands might want them to cover or not cover. So again, there's so many factors here. If you have a look at one good way of getting an idea of it, if you have a look at YouTubes of city tours in the Muslim world, you'll see the variety. If you choose, I don't know, say put in Lahore, Pakistan, and have a look at, you know, what do people look like there, or Sana'a, Yemen, what do people look like there, or Indonesia, what are the women wearing there, and you'll see it varies enormously, and you'll see more than one style too. It is very, very various. Rivka's putting on a wedding veil. We don't know if they had wedding veils. The Romans had wedding veils. There's no mention in any early Jewish sources of wedding bells.
Sarah, and you know, she has an interlude with Avimelech, and he provides her with kesut einayich. It's a veil covering the eyes, and he kind of...
Well, no, kesut einayich could just mean covering the eyes. I will give you something so that nobody will see what has been done. It might not be a garment. Again, you're down to interpretation. It's not at all clear that kesut einayich is a garment. So we honestly don't know. We have a very little bit of pictorial evidence from archaeology. The black obelisk of Shalmaneser of the third has some Israelite women, and they are wearing something that sort of, it's like a some sort of thing that goes down to about knee length. And they've got fairly short skirts, a bit below the knees, and bare legs, apparently. So, you know, in the seventh, eighth, I can't remember when Shalmaneser III is now, in that century, apparently that's what we think that Assyrians thought Israelite women looked like. But whether the Assyrian artist had ever seen an Israelite woman or was just commissioned to do weirdo people from abroad and make it up, we don't know. And we have those little pottery figurines. Again, it's a bit difficult to tell what they're wearing. Are they wearing something or is it just their hair? It's not quite clear. The little Israelite pottery figurines are often playing musical instruments. Sometimes they have quite prominent breasts. So the question is, oh, are they fertility figures or what? And again, we don't actually know what the function of those figures were, so we don't know what the relationship is to ordinary women. And we suffer from a terrible lack of knowledge. And rather bitty texts because they didn't need to tell us, you know, they knew what people were wearing and what was the point of writing it, you know, when just the storyline. So it's so hard to know. Ancient Mesopotamia, there does seem to have been use of veils for very prosperous women. It was in many societies, it's only women at the top who are veiled because that means they often can't work in the fields and things. So in India, women in Purda were upper class, working class women had to go out and work. They couldn't be completely covered up and separated and what have you. So it was often a prestige thing. If you could shut your women up in the house, that showed you were rich. So that's a ritual. Does Islam have a ritual that allows to for freedom of dress as it's Purim? No. What's the recent reason behind some rabbis in Israel for having women wearing almost hijab? Oh, and it's the women. The women, the Taliban women, and the rabbis are dead against it. This is a fascinating thing. They're mostly Baalot Tshuva, who've become very, very Haredi, and some of them wear 7 black shawls over their heads. You can't see them at all. And you see their kids sort of piloting them around because they really can't see out of that. It's quite controversial. One woman who was, they also won't allow their husbands to see female children from the age of 3 upwards. There's also a sect called Lev Tahor, which you might know because they ended up in Canada at one point, who were charged with child abuse because, you know, there was complete segregation of little girls that weren't getting any education. The Jerusalem Shal women or Taliban women have been openly rebuked by Haredi rabbis who really disapprove, I think largely because the women have taken matters into their own hands and they've decided what they're wearing. One of the leaders of the group was imprisoned for neglect of a child. So they are very odd, very extreme. There are not a lot of them. And they mostly actually originally come from a secular background and are about to. There are some studies of them. And it's a fascinating phenomenon. I sort of see it as maybe in a world where gender segregation is taken to such an extreme, all you can do eventually is say, I make the rules. And I will make it even more extreme. But now I am the one with the power. I am the one keeping the men away. I am the one hiding myself and blotting myself out. And I am the one who chooses not to be seen. Sometimes they have a sort of an ideology of there being power and hidden things. And I interviewed a Satmar woman once who said, it's like an electric power station. The more hidden things are, the more powerful they are. And she felt very, very powerful indeed. She couldn't feel at all oppressed. I don't think she was oppressed. She saw herself as, she said, my husband's like the foreign minister, I'm like the interior minister. And she was a most unusual woman. I don't know if many of her peers would have been that thoughtful. She was a very, very interesting woman. So what I think for the next series, I don't know. It depends upon us. We've done the bottom. Does Islam have a freedom time like Purim? No, it doesn't at all. It has very, very few festivals, really. It's got Ramadan, it's got the Hajj season, which is pretty big, and then it's got these two festivals, Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha, ones at the end of Ramadan. and the other is, when does it come out? Oh, I can't remember. But that's it. Judaism is a remarkably festival rich religion. Medieval Christianity was very festival rich because you had saints days every other five minutes. It's another saint. Well, every day was a saint's day. But Islam hasn't got a lot of festivals, and it doesn't have anything cognate with Purim at all. So then I think we got down to the bottom of the questions. I'm sorry, I'm sort of hiding the corner here. The sun is shining directly in my eyes. It's actually sunny in London for once. And thank you all so much for coming to the course. I thoroughly enjoyed this group. Lots of fabulous questions. And I hope I'll be back to teach you something at some point. And in the meantime, stay well and have a lovely, lovely Purim.
Thank you very much. It was absolutely marvelous. I hope to see you again teaching.
Yeah. Thank you very, very much indeed. Well, you've been a marvelous class, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
More than welcome.